"Matrimony was ordained thirdly," said Jane Stoddock to herself, "for the mutual society, help, and comfort that one ought to have of the other." She had not been to church since her school days, until she went there 6 months ago to be married, and the words of the service had stuck in her mind. Through the open door she could see the tiny kitchen of the flat and hear the loud, ungentle tick-tock of the clock. She had just left the kitchen and knew how tidy it was. The breakfast things were washed up, the tea towels were hanging above the stove, and the floor was mopped. The beds were made and the rooms done. She had just returned from the only shopping she need do that day, and it was still a minute before 11. Except for getting her own lunch and tea, there was nothing that had to be done till 6 o'clock, and even supposing that Mark was really coming home for dinner. But there was a college meeting today. Almost certainly Mark would ring up about tea time to say that the meeting was taking longer than he had expected, and that he would have to dine in college. The hours before her were as empty as the flat. The sun shone, and the clock ticked. "Mutual society, help, and comfort," said Jane bitterly. In reality, marriage had proved to be the door out of a world of work and comradeship and laughter and innumerable things to do into something like solitary confinement. For some years before their marriage, she had never seen so little of Mark as she had done in the last 6 months. Even when he was at home, he hardly ever talked. He was always either sleepy or intellectually preoccupied. While they had been friends, and later, when they were lovers, life itself had seemed too short for all they had to say to each other. But now, why had he married her? Was he still in love? If so, being in love must mean totally different things to men and women. Was it the crude truth that all the endless talks which had seemed to her, before they were married, the very medium of love itself, had never been to him more than preliminary? "Here I am, starting to waste another morning. Mooning," said Jane to herself sharply. "I must do some work." By work she meant her doctorate thesis on Donne. She'd always intended to continue her own career as a scholar after she was married. That was one of the reasons why they were not to have children, at any rate for a long time yet. Jane was not perhaps a very original thinker, and her plan had been to lay great stress on Donne's triumphant vindication of the body. She still believed that if she got out all her notebooks and editions and really sat down to the job, she could force herself back into the lost enthusiasm for the subject. But before she did so, perhaps in order to put off the moment of beginning, she turned over a newspaper which was lying on the table and glanced at a picture on the back page. The moment she saw the picture, she remembered her dream. She remembered not only the dream, but the measureless time after she had crept out of bed and sat waiting for the first hint of morning, afraid to put on the light for fear Mark should wake up and fuss, yet feeling offended by the sound of his regular breathing. He was an excellent sleeper. Only one thing ever seemed to be able to keep him awake after he had gone to bed, and even that did not keep him awake for long. The terror of this dream, like the terror of most dreams, evaporates in the telling, but it must be set down for the sake of what comes afterwards. She had begun by dreaming simply of a face. It was a foreign-looking face, bearded and rather yellow, with a hooked nose. Its expression was frightening because it was frightened. The mouth sagged open and the eyes stared, as she had seen other men stare for a second or two when some sudden shock had occurred. But this face seemed to be meeting a shock that lasted for hours. Then gradually she became aware of more. The face belonged to a man who was sitting hunched up in one corner of a little square room with whitewashed walls, waiting, she thought, for those who had him in their power to come in and do something horrible to him. At last the door was opened, and a rather good-looking man with a pointed grey beard came in. The prisoner seemed to recognize him as an old acquaintance, and they sat down together and began to talk. In all the dreams which Jane had hitherto dreamed, one either understood what the dream people were saying, or else one did not hear it. But in this dream, and that helped to make its extraordinary realism, the conversation was in French, and Jane understood bits of it, but by no means all, just as she would have done in real life. The visitor was telling the prisoner something which he apparently intended him to regard as good news, and the prisoner at first looked up with a gleam of hope in his eye, and said, "Tiens, ah, a Mark," but then he wavered and changed his mind. The visitor continued in a low, fluent voice to press his point. He was a good-looking man in his rather cold way, but he wore pince-nez, and these kept on catching the light so as to make his eyes invisible. This, combined with the almost unnatural perfection of his teeth, somehow gave Jane a disagreeable impression. and this was increased by the growing distress and finally the terror of the prisoner. She could not make out what it was that the visitor was proposing to him, but she did discover that the prisoner was under sentence of death. Whatever the prisoner was offering him was something that frightened him more than that. At this point, the dream abandoned all pretense to realism and became ordinary nightmare. The visitor, adjusting his pince-nez and still smiling his cold smile, seized the prisoner's head between his two hands. He gave it a sharp turn, just as Jane had last summer seen men give a sharp turn to the helmet on a diver's head. The visitor unscrewed the prisoner's head and took it away. Then all became confused. The head was still the center of the dream, but it was quite a different head now, a head with flowing white beard all covered with earth. It belonged to an old man whom some people were digging up in a kind of churchyard, a sort of ancient British druidical kind of man, in a long mantle. Jane didn't mind this much at first because she thought it was a corpse. But then suddenly she noticed that the ancient thing was coming to life. "Look out!" she cried in her dream. "He's alive! Stop! Stop! You're waking him!" But they did not stop. The old buried man sat up and began talking in something that sounded vaguely like Spanish. And this, for some reason, frightened Jane so badly that she woke up. That was the dream. No worse, if also no better, than many other nightmare. But it was not the mere memory of a nightmare that made the sitting room of the flat swim before Jane's eyes and caused her to sit down quickly for fear she should fall. The trouble was elsewhere. There on the back page of the newspaper was the head she had seen in the nightmare. The first head, if there had been two of them, the head of the prisoner. With extreme reluctance she took up the paper. "Execution of Alcazan" was the headline, and beneath it, "Scientist Bluebeard goes to guillotine." She remembered having vaguely followed the case. Alcazan was a distinguished radiologist in the neighboring country, an Arab by descent, they said, who had cut short an otherwise brilliant career by poisoning his wife. So that was the origin of her dream. She must have looked at this photo in the paper. The man certainly had a very unpleasant face. Before going to bed. But no, that couldn't be it. It was this morning's paper. But of course there must have been some earlier picture which she had seen and forgotten. Probably 2 weeks ago when the trial began. It was silly to have let it give her such a turn. And now for Don. Let's see, where were we? The ambiguous passage at the end of Love's Alchemy. "Hope not for mind in woman, at their best sweetness and wit. They are but mummy possessed." Hope not for mind in woman. Did any man really want mind in woman? But that wasn't the point. "I must get back my power of concentrating," said Jane. And then, was there a previous picture of Alcazan? Supposing... 5 minutes later, she swept all her books away, went to the mirror, put on her hat, and went out. She was not quite sure where she was going. Anyway, to be out of that room, the flat, that whole house. Mark, himself, meanwhile, was walking down to Bracton College and thinking of a very different matter. He did not notice at all the morning beauty of the little street that led him from the sandy hillside suburb where he and Jane lived, down the central and academic part of Edgestow. Though I am Oxford-bred and very fond of Cambridge, I think that Edgestow is more beautiful than either. For one thing, it is so small. No maker of cars or sausages or marmalades has yet come to industrialize the country town, which is the setting of the university, and the university itself is tiny. Apart from Bracton, and from the 19th century women's college beyond the railway, there are only two colleges, Northumberland, which stands below Bracton on the River Wind, and Duke's opposite the Abbey. Bracton takes no undergraduates. It was founded in 1300 for the support of 10 learned men whose duties were to pray for the soul of Henry de Bracton and to study the laws of England. A number of fellows had gradually increased to 40, of whom only 6, apart from the Bacon professor, now study law, and whom none, perhaps, pray for the soul of Bracton. Mark Studdock was himself a sociologist, and had been elected to fellowship in that subject 5 years ago. He was beginning to find his feet. If he had felt any doubt on that point, which he did not, it would have been laid to rest when he found himself meeting Curry just outside the post office, and seen how natural Curry found it that they should walk to college together and discuss the agenda for the meeting. Curry was the sub-warden of Bracton. "Yes," said Curry, "it will take a hell of a time. Probably go on after dinner. We shall have all the obstructionists wasting time as hard as they can. But luckily that's the worst they can do." You would have never have guessed from the tone of Studdock's reply what intense pleasure he derived from Curry's use of the pronoun we. So very recently he had been an outsider, watching the proceedings of what he called Curry and his gang, with awe and with little understanding, and making at college meeting short, nervous speeches which never influenced the course of events. Now he was inside, and Curry and his gang had become we, or the progressive element, in college. It had all happened quite suddenly, and was still sweet in the mouth. "You think it'll go through then?" said Starrock. "Sure to," said Curry. "We've got the warden and the bursar, and all the chemical and biochemical people for a start. I've tackled Pelham and Ted, and they're sound. I've made Sancho believe that he sees the point, and that he's in favor for it. Bill the Blizzard will probably do something pretty devastating, but he's bound to side with us if it comes to a vote. Besides, I haven't told you, Dick's going to be there. He's come up in time for dinner last night and got busy at once." Stardock's mind darted hither and thither in search of some safe way to conceal the fact that he did not know who Dick was. In the nick of time, he remembered a very obscure colleague whose Christian name was Richard. "Telford?" said Stardock in a puzzled voice. He knew very well that Telford could not be the Dick that Curry meant, and therefore threw a slightly whimsical and ironical tone into his question. "Good Lord, Telford," said Curry with a laugh. "No, I mean Lord Feverstone, Dick Devine as he used to be." "I was a little baffled by the idea of Telford," said Stardock, joining in the laugh. "I'm glad Feverstone is coming. I've never met him, you know." "Oh, but you must," said Curry. "Look here, come and dine in my room tonight. I've asked him." "I should like to very much," said Stardock, quite truly. "By the way, I suppose Feverstone's own position is quite secure?"
"How do you mean?" asked Curry.
"Well, there was some talk, if you remember, as to whether someone who was quite away so much could go on holding a fellowship."
"Oh, you mean Glossop and all that ramp. Nothing will come of that. Didn't you think it absolute blah?"
"As between ourselves, yes. But I confess if I were put up to explain in public exactly why a man who is nearly always in London should go on being a fellow of Bracton, I shouldn't find it altogether easy. The real reasons are the sort that Watson would call imponderables."
"I don't agree. I should have the least objection to explaining the real reasons in public. Isn't it important for a college like this to have influential connections with the outer world? It's not in the least impossible that Dick would be in the next cabinet. Even already Dick in London has been a damn sight more use to the college than Glossop and half a dozen others of that sort have been sitting here all their lives."
"Yes, of course, that's the real point. It would be a little difficult to put that form at a college meeting, though."
"There's one thing," said Curry, in a slightly less intimate tone, "that perhaps you ought to know about Dick."
"What's that?"
"He got you your fellowship."
Mark was silent.
He did not like things which reminded him that he had once been not only outside the progressive element, but even outside the college. He did not always like Curry either. His pleasure in being with him was not that sort of pleasure.
"Yes," said Curry, "Denniston was your chief rival. Between ourselves, a good many people liked his paper better than yours. It was Dick who insisted all through that you were the sort of man we really wanted. He went around to Dukes and ferreted out all about you. He took the line that the one thing to consider is the type of man we need, and be damned to paper qualifications. And I must say he turned out to be right."
"Very kind of you," said Stardock, with a little mock bow. He was surprised at the turn of the conversation.
It was an old rule at Bracton, as presumably in most colleges, that one never mentioned in the presence of a man the circumstances of his own election, and Stardock had not realized till now that this was also one of the traditions the progressive element was prepared to scrap. It had also never occurred to him that his own election had depended on anything but the excellence of his work in the fellowship examination, still less that it had been so narrow a thing. He was so accustomed to his position by now that this thought gave him the same curious sensation which a man has when he discovers that his father once very nearly married a different woman.
"Yes," continued Curry, pursuing another train of thought, "one sees now that Denniston would never have done, most emphatically not. A brilliant man at the time, of course, but he seems to have gone quite off the rails since then with all his distributivism and what not. They tell me he's likely to end up in a monastery."
"He's no fool all the same," said Stardock.
"I'm glad you're going to meet Dick," said Curry. "We haven't time now, but there's one thing about him I wanted to discuss with you."
Stardock looked inquiringly at him.
"James and I and one or two others," said Curry, in a somewhat lower voice, "have been thinking he ought to be the new warden. But here we are."
"It's not yet 12, said Stardock. "What about popping into the Bristol for a drink?"
Into the Bristol they accordingly went. It would not have been easy to preserve the atmosphere in which the progressive element operated without a good many of these little courtesies. This weighed harder on Studdock than on Curry, who was unmarried and had a sub-warden stipend, but Bristol was a very pleasant place. Studdock bought himself a double whiskey for his companion and half a pint of beer for himself. "The only time I was a guest at Bracton, I persuaded my host to let me into the wood and leave me there alone for an hour. He apologized for locking me in. Very few people were allowed into Bracton Wood. The gate was in Inigo Jones and was the only entry. A high wall enclosed the wood, which was perhaps a quarter of a mile broad and a mile from east to west. If you came in from the street and went through the college to reach it, the sense of gradual penetration into a holy of holies was very strong. First you went through the Newton Quadrangle, which is dry and gravelly, florid but beautiful. Gregorian buildings look down upon it. Next you must enter a cool, tunnel-like passage, nearly dark at midday, unless either the door into hall should be open on your right, or the buttery hatch on your left, giving you a glimpse of indoor daylight falling on panels, and a whiff of the smell of fresh bread. When you emerged from this tunnel, you would find yourself in the medieval college, in the cloister of the much smaller quadrangle called Republic. The grass here looks very green after the aridity of Newton, and the very stone of the buttresses that rise from it gives the impression of being soft and alive. Chapel is not far off. The hoarse, heavy noise of the works of the great and old clock come to you from somewhere overhead. You went along this cloister, past the slabs and urns and busts that commemorate dead Bractonians, and then down shallow steps into the full daylight of the quadrangle called Lady Alice. The buildings to your left and right were 17th century work, humble, almost domestic in character, with dormer windows, mossy and grey-tiled. You were in a sweet Protestant world. You found yourself, perhaps, thinking of Bunyan or of Walton's Lives. There were no buildings straight ahead on the fourth side of Lady Alice, only a row of elms and a wall, and here first one becomes aware of the sound of running water and the cooing of wood pigeons. The street was so far off by now that there were no other noises. In the wall there was a door. It led you into a covered gallery, pierced with narrow windows on either side. Looking out through these, you discovered that you were crossing a bridge, and a dark brown, dimpled wind was flowing under you. Now you were very near your goal. A wicket at the far end of the bridge brought you out on the fellow's bowling green, and across that you saw the high wall of the wood, and through the Inigo Jones gate, you caught a glimpse of sunlight green and deep shadows. I suppose the mere fact of being walled in gave the wood part of its peculiar quality, for when a thing is enclosed, the mind does not willingly regard it as common. As I went forward over the quiet turf, I had the sense of being received. The trees were just so wide apart that one saw uninterrupted foliage in the distance, but the place where one stood seemed always to be a clearing, surrounded by a world of shadows. One walked in mild sunshine. Except for the sheep, whose nibbling kept the grass so short, and who sometimes raised their long, foolish faces to stare at me, I was quite alone, and it felt more like the loneliness of a very large room in a deserted house than like any ordinary solitude out of doors. I remember thinking, this is the sort of place which, as a child, one would have been rather afraid of, or else would have liked very much indeed. A moment later, I thought, but when alone, really alone, everyone is a child, or no one. Youth and age touch only the surface of our lives. Half a mile is a short walk, yet it seemed a long time before I came to the center of the wood. I knew it was the center, for there was the thing I had chiefly come to see. It was a well with steps going down into it, and the remains of an ancient pavement about it. It was very imperfect now. I did not step on it, but lay down in the grass and touched it with my fingers. For this was the heart of Bracton, or Bragdon Wood. Out of this all the legends had come, and on this I suspected the very existence of the college had originally depended. The archaeologists were agreed that the masonry was very late British Roman work, done on the eve of the Anglo-Saxon invasion. How Bragdon the Wood was connected with Bracton the lawyer was a mystery, but I fancy myself that the Bracton family had availed themselves of an accidental similarity in the names to believe, or make believe, that they had something to do with it. Certainly, if all that was told were true, or even half of it, the wood was older than the Bractons. I suppose no one now would lend much importance to Strabo's Balacthon, although it led a 16th century warden of the college to say that, We know not by ancientest report of any Briton without Bragdon. But the medieval song takes us back to the 14th century. In Brandenbrich descended I, heard echt Merlin there be lie, singing the woo and well away. It is good enough evidence that the well with the British Roman pavement was already Merlin's Well, though the name is not found till Queen Elizabeth's reign, when good warden Shovel surrounded the wood with a wall. For the taking away of all profane and heathenish superstitions, and the deterrings of the vulgar sort from all wakes, May games, dancings, mummings, and bakings of Morgan's bread. Therefore, too, to be about a fountain, called in vanity Merlin's Well, and utterly to be renounced and abominated as a gallifoundry of papistry, gentilism, lewdness, and dunsical folly. Not that the college had by this action renounced its own interest in the place. Old Dr. Shovel, who lived to be nearly 100, can scarcely have been cold in his grave when one of Cromwell's major generals, conceiving it his business to destroy the groves and the high places, sent a few troopers with power to impress the country people for this pious work. The scheme came to nothing in the end, but there had been a bicker between the college and the troopers in the heart of Bragdon, and the famously learned and saintly Richard Crowe had been killed by a musket ball on the very steps of the well. He would be a brave man who would accuse Crowe either of popery or gentilism. Yet the story is that his last words had been, "Marry, sirs, if Merlin, who was the devil's son, was a true king's man, ever ate bread, it is not a shame that you, being but the sons of bitches, must be rebels and regicides." And always, through all changes, every warden of Bracton on the day of his election had drunk a ceremonial draught of water from Merlin's Well in the great cup, which, for both its antiquity and beauty, was the greatest of the Bracton treasures. All of this I thought of, lying beside Merlin's Well, beside the well which must certainly date from Merlin's time if there had ever been a real Merlin, lying where Sir Kenelm Digby had lain all one summer night and had seen a certain strange appearance, where Collins the poet had lain, and where George the Third had cried, where the brilliant and much-loved Nathaniel Fox had composed the famous poem 3 weeks before he was killed in France. The air was so still, and the billows of the foliage so heavy above me, that I fell asleep. I was awakened by my friend hallooing to me from a long way off.